On Friday, at 12:45 p.m, David arrived at the Athenaeum, a massive white building on the corner of Pall Mall, overlooked by a statue of the Duke of York. David was amazed by the size of the rooms, and his commercial mind could not help wondering what price they would fetch as office space. The place appeared to be full of moving waxworks who, Robin later assured him, were in fact distinguished generals and diplomats. They lunched in the coffee room, dominated by a Rubens of Charles II, and talked about Boston, London, squash, and their shared passion for Katharine Hepburn. Over coffee, David readily told Robin the details of the geologist's findings on the Prospector oil site. The shares had now climbed to £3.60 on the London Stock Exchange, and were still going up.
"Sounds like a good investment," said Robin, "and as it's your own company, it might be worth the risk."
"I don't think there's much of a risk," said David, "as long as the oil is actually there."
"Well, I'll certainly consider it most seriously over the weekend."
They parted on the steps of the Athenaeum, David to a conference on the energy crisis organized by the Financial Times, Robin to his home in Berkshire. His two young sons were back from prep school for the weekend, and he was looking forward to seeing them again. How quickly they had passed from babies to toddlers to boys. Soon they would be young men, he thought, and how reassuring to know their future was secure. Perhaps he should make that future a little more secure by investing in David Kessler's company. He could always put the money back into blue-chip shares once the strike had been announced. Bernie Silverman was also pleased to hear the possibility of a further investment.
"Congratulations, my boy. We're going to need a lot of capital to finance the pipe-laying operations, you know. Pipe-laying can cost $2 million per mile. Still, you're playing your part. I've just had word from head office that we are to give you a $5,000 bonus for your efforts. Keep up the good work."
David smiled. This was business in the proper Harvard tradition. If you bring home the results, you get the rewards.
"When will the strike be officially announced?" he asked.
"Sometime in the next few days." David left Silverman's office with a glow of pride. Silverman immediately contacted Harvey Metcalf on the red phone, and he set the routine in motion once again. Metcalf's brokers released onto the market 35,000 shares at £3.73 and approximately 5,000 each day onto the open market, always being able to feel when the market had taken enough and thus keeping the price steady. Once again, the shares climbed when Dr. Oakley invested heavily in the market, this time to £3.90, keeping David, Robin and Stephen all happy. They were not to know that Harvey was releasing more shares each day because of the interest they had caused, and that this was now creating a market of its own. David decided to spend some of his bonus on a painting for his little flat in the Barbican, which he felt was rather grey. About $2,000, he thought, something that was going to appreciate in value. David quite enjoyed art for art's sake, but he liked it even more for business's sake. He spent Friday afternoon tramping around Bond Street, Cork Street and Bruton Street, the home of the London Art Galleries. The Wildenstein was too expensive for his pocket and the Marlborough too modern for his taste. The painting he finally picked out was at the Lamont Gallery in Bond Street. The gallery, just three doors away from Sotheby's, consisted of one vast room with a worn grey carpet and red faded wallpaper. As David was later to learn, the more worn the carpet, the more faded the walls, the greater the success and reputation of the gallery. There was a staircase at the far end of the room, against which some unregarded paintings were stacked, backs to the world. David sorted through them on a whim and found, to his delight, something that appealed to him. It was an oil by Leon Underwood called Venus in the Park. The large, rather somber canvas contained about six men and women sitting on metal chairs at circular tea tables. Among them, in the foreground, was a comely naked woman with generous breasts and long hair. Nobody was paying her the slightest attention, and she sat gazing out of the picture, face inscrutable, a symbol of warmth and love in indifferent surroundings. David found her utterly compelling. The gallery proprietor, Jean-Pierre Lamann, advanced on him, adorned in an elegantly tailored suit, as befitted a man who rarely received checks for less than £1,000. At 35, he could afford the little extravagances of life, and his Gucci shoes, Yves Saint Laurent tie,
Turnbull and Asser shirt and Piaget watch left no one, especially women, in any doubt that he knew what he was about. He was an Englishman's vision of a Frenchman, slim and neat, with longish, dark, wavy hair and deep brown eyes that hinted at being a little sharp. He was capable of being persnickety and demanding, with a wit that was often as cruel as it was amusing, which may have been one of the reasons why he had not married. There certainly had been no shortage of applicants. Customers, however, saw only his charming side. As David wrote out his check, Jean-Pierre rubbed his forefinger backward and forward over his fashionable moustache, only too happy to discuss the picture.
Underwood is one of the greatest sculptors and artists in England today. He even tutored Henry Moore, you know. I believe he is underestimated because of his dislike of journalists and the press, whom he describes as nothing more than drunken scribblers.
Hardly the way to endear oneself to the media, murmured David, as he handed over the check for £850, feeling agreeably prosperous. Although it was the most expensive purchase he had ever made, he felt the picture was a good investment and, more important, he liked it. Jean-Pierre took David downstairs to show him the impressionist and modern collection he had built up over many years, continuing to enthuse about Underwood. They celebrated David's first acquisition over a whiskey in Jean-Pierre's office.
"What line of business are you in, Mr. Gessler?"
"I work with a small oil company called Prospector Oil, who are exploring prospects in the North Sea."
"Had any success?"
inquired Jean-Pierre, a little too innocently. "Well, between the two of us, we're rather excited about the future. It's no secret that the company shares have gone from £2 to nearly £4 in the last few weeks, but no one knows the real reason.
Would it be a good investment for a poor little art dealer like myself?" asked Jean-Pierre. "I'll tell you how good an investment I think it is," said David.
"I am putting $3,000 in the company on Monday, which is all I have left in the world, now that I've captured Venus, that is. We'll shortly be making a rather important announcement." A twinkle came into Jean-Pierre's eye. To one of his Gallic subtlety, a nod was as good as a wink. He did not pursue the line of conversation any further.
"When's the strike going to be announced, Bernie?"
"I'm expecting it early next week. We've had a few problems. Nothing we can't lick, though." That gave David some relief, as he had taken up 500 shares himself that morning, investing the remaining $3,000 from his bonus. Like the others, he was hoping for a quick profit.
"Row, Rudd.
Frank Watts, please. Jean-Pierre Lamann."
"Good morning, Jean-Pierre. What can we do for you?"
"I want to buy 25,000 Prospector Oil."
"Never heard of them. Hold on a minute. New company? Very low capital. A bit risky, JP. I wouldn't recommend it."
"It's all right, Frank. I only want them for 2 or 3 weeks. Then you can sell. I've no intention of holding on to them. When did the account start?"
"Yesterday."
"Right. Buy this morning and sell them before the end of the account, or earlier. I'm expecting an announcement next week, so once they go over £5, you can get rid of them. No need to be greedy, but buy them in my company name. I don't want the deal traced back to me. It might embarrass the informant."
"Right, sir. Buy 25,000 Prospector Oil at market price and sell before the last day of the account, or sooner if instructed."
"Correct. I'll be in Paris all next week looking at pictures, so don't hesitate to sell once they go over £5.
"Right, JP. Have a good trip."
The red telephone rang.
"Row Rudd are looking for a substantial block of shares. Do you know anything about it?"
"No idea, Harvey. It must be David Kessler again. Do you want me to speak to him?"
"No, say nothing. I've released another 25,000 shares at £3.90. Kessler's only got to do one more big one, and I'll be out. Prepare our plan for 7 days before the end of this stock exchange account."
"Right, boss. You know quite a few people are also buying in small amounts."
"Yes, just as before. They all have to tell their friends they're onto a good thing. Say nothing to Kessler."
"You know, David," said Richard Elliot, "you work too hard. Relax. We're going to have enough work on our hands when the announcement's made."
"I guess so," said David.
Work's just a habit with me now. Well, why don't you take tonight off and join me for a spot of something at Annabelle's?
David was flattered by the invitation to London's most exclusive nightclub and accepted enthusiastically. David's hired Ford Cortina looked somewhat out of place that evening in Berkeley Square, among the double-parked Rolls Royces and Mercedes. He made his way down the little iron staircase into the basement, which at one time must have been no more than the servants' quarters for the elegant townhouse above. Now it was a splendid club, with a restaurant, discotheque, and a small elegant bar, the walls covered in old prints and pictures. The main dining room was dimly lit and crowded with small tables, most of them already occupied. The decor was Regency and extravagant. Mark Burley, the owner, had, in the short period of 10 years, made Annabelle's the most sought-after club in London, with a waiting list for membership of well over 1,000. The discotheque was playing in the far corner of a crowded dance floor, on which you couldn't have parked 2 Cadillacs. Most of the couples were dancing very close to each other. They had little choice. David was somewhat surprised to observe that nearly all of the men on the floor were about 20 years older than the girls they held in their arms. The head waiter, Louis, showed David to Richard Elliot's table. Realizing it was David's first visit to the club, by the way he stared at all the personalities of the day. Oh well, thought David, perhaps one day they'll be staring at me. After an exceptionally good dinner, Richard Elliot and his wife joined the crowd on the dance floor, while David returned to the little bar surrounded by comfortable red settees and struck up a conversation with someone who introduced himself as James Briggsley. Even if he did not treat the whole world as such, Mr. Briggsley certainly treated Annabelle's as a stage. Tall, blonde, and aristocratic, his eyes alight with good humour, he seemed at ease with everyone around him. David admired his assured manner, something he had never acquired and feared he never would. His accent, even to David's untutored ears, was resonantly upper class. David's new acquaintance talked of his visits to the States, flattering him by remarking how much he had always liked the Americans. After some time, David was able quietly to ask the head waiter who the Englishman was. "He's Lord Briggsley, the eldest son of the Earl of Louth, sir." "What do you know?" thought David. "Lords look like anyone else, especially when they've had a few drinks." Lord Briggsley was tapping David's glass. "Would you care for another?" "Thank you very much, my lord," said David. "Don't bother with all that nonsense. The name's James. What are you doing in London?"
"I work for an oil company. You probably know my chairman, Lord Honeysett. I've never met him myself, to tell you the truth."
"Sweet old buffer," said James. "His son and I were at Harrow together. If you're in oil, perhaps you can tell me what to do with my Shell and BP shares."
"Hold on to them," said David. "It's sensible to remain in any commodities, especially oil, as long as the British government doesn't get greedy and try to take control of the assets themselves." Another double whiskey arrived. David was beginning to feel just slightly tipsy.
"What about your own company?" inquired James.
"We're rather small," said David, "but our shares have gone up more than any other oil company in the last 3 months. Even so, I suspect they've nowhere near reached their zenith."
"Why?" demanded James.
David glanced round and lowered his voice to a confidential whisper.
"Well, I expect you realize that if you make an oil strike in a big company, it can only put the percentage of your profits up by a tiny amount. But if you make a strike in a small company, naturally that profit will be reflected as a considerably larger percentage of the whole."
"Are you telling me you've made a strike?"
"Perhaps I shouldn't have said that," said David. "I'd be obliged if you'd treat that remark in confidence."
David could not remember how he arrived home, or who put him to bed, and he appeared rather late in the office the next morning.
"I am sorry, Bernie. I overslept after a very good evening with Richard at Annabelle's."
"Doesn't matter a bit. Glad you enjoyed yourself. I hope I wasn't indiscreet, but I told some lord, whose name I can't even remember, that he ought to invest in the company. I may have been a little too enthusiastic."
"Don't worry, David. We're not going to let anyone down, and you need the rest.
You've been working your ass off."
James Briggsley left his London flat in Chelsea and took a taxi to his bank, Williams and Glynn's. James was an extrovert by nature,
and at Harrow his only real love had been acting. But when he had left school, his father had refused to allow him to go on the stage and insisted that he complete his education at Christ Church, Oxford, where again he took a greater interest in the dramatic society than in gaining a degree in his chosen subject of politics, philosophy, and economics. James had never mentioned to anyone, since leaving Oxford, the class of degree he managed to secure, but for better or worse, the fourth class honours degree was later abolished. After Oxford, he joined the Grenadier Guards, who gave him considerable scope for his histrionic talents. This was indeed to be James's introduction to society life in London, and he succeeded as well as a personable, rich young viscount might be expected to do in the circumstances. When he had completed his 2 years in the Guards, the Earl gave him a 250-acre farm in Hampshire to occupy his time, but James did not care for the coarser country life. He left the running of the farm to a manager and once again concentrated on his social life in London. He would dearly have liked to go on the stage, but he knew the old man still considered Mrs. Worthington's daughter's ambition an improper one for a future peer of the realm. The fifth Earl didn't think a great deal of his eldest son one way and another, and James did not find it easy to persuade his father that he was shrewder than he was given credit for. Perhaps the inside information David Kessler had let slip, after a few drinks, would give him the opportunity to prove his old dad wrong. In Williams and Glynn's fine old building in Birchin Lane, James was ushered into the manager's office. "I should like to borrow some money against my farm in Hampshire," said Lord Briggsley. Philip Izard, the manager, knew Lord Briggsley well and was also acquainted with his father. Although he had respect for the Earl's judgment, he did not have a great deal of time for the young lord. Nevertheless, it was not for him to query a customer's request, especially when the customer's family was one of the longest standing in the bank's history. "Yes, my lord, what sum do you have in mind?" "Well, it seems that farmland in Hampshire is worth about £1,000 an acre, and is still climbing. Why don't we say £150,000? I should then like to invest the money in shares. Will you agree to leave the deeds with the bank as security?" inquired Izard. "Yes, of course. What difference does it make to me where they are?" "Then I am sure we will find it acceptable to advance you a loan of £150,000 at 2% above base rate." James was not at all sure what base rate was, but he knew that Williams and Glynn's were as competitive as everyone else in such matters, and that their reputation was beyond dispute. "Thank you," said James. "Please acquire for me 35,000 shares in a company called Prospector Oil." "Have you checked carefully into this company, my lord?" inquired Izard. "Yes, of course I have," said Lord Briggsley, very sharply. He was not in awe of the bank managerial class. In Boston, Harvey Metcalf was briefed over the telephone by Silverman of the meeting in Annabelle's between David Kessler and a nameless peer, who seemed to have more money than sense. Harvey released 40,000 shares onto the market at £4.80. Williams and Glynn's acquired 35,000 of them, and once again, the remainder was taken up by small investors. The shares rose a little. Harvey Metcalf was now left with only 30,000 shares of his own, and over the next 4 days, he was able to dispose of them all. It had taken him 14 weeks to offload his entire stock in Prospector Oil at a profit of just over $6 million. On Friday morning, the share stood at £4.90, and Kessler had, in all innocence, occasioned four large investments. Harvey Metcalf studied them in detail before putting through a call to Jörg Bierer. Stephen Bradley had bought 40,000 shares at $6.10. Dr. Robin Oakley had bought 35,000 shares at $7.23. Jean-Pierre Lamann had bought 25,000 shares at $7.80. James Briggsley had bought 35,000 shares at $8.80. David Kessler himself had bought 500 shares at $7.25. Among them, they had purchased 135,500 shares at a cost of just over $1 million. They had also kept the price rising, giving Harvey the chance to offload all his own stock onto a natural market. Harvey Metcalf had done it again. His name was not on the letterhead, and now he possessed no shares. Nobody would be able to place any blame on him. He had done nothing illegal. Even the geologist's report contained enough ifs and buts to pass in a court of law. As for David Kessler, Harvey could not be blamed for his youthful over-enthusiasm. He had never even met the man. Harvey Metcalf opened a bottle of Krug Privé Cuvée 1964, imported from Hedges and Butler of London. He sipped it slowly, then lit a Romeo y Julieta Churchill, and settled back for a mild celebration. David, Stephen, Robin, Jean-Pierre, and James celebrated at the weekend as well. Why not? Their shares were at £4.90, and David had assured them all that they would reach £10. On Saturday morning, David ordered his first bespoke suit from Aquascutum. Stephen tut-tutted his way through the end-of-vacation examination papers he had set his freshman students. Robin attended his son's prep school sports day. Jean-Pierre reframed a Renoir, and James Briggsley went shooting, convinced that at last he had one in the eye for his father.
Chapter 3. David arrived at the office at 9 a.m. on Monday to find that the front door was locked. He could not understand it. The secretaries were supposed to be in by 8:45. After waiting around for over an hour, he walked to the nearest telephone box and dialed Bernie Silverman's home number. There was no reply. He then rang Richard Elliott at home. The ringing tone continued. He rang the Aberdeen office with the same result. He decided to return to the office. There must be a simple explanation, he thought. Was he daydreaming, or was it Sunday? No, the streets were jammed with people and cars. When he arrived back at the office, a young man was nailing up a board. 2,500 square feet to let. Aptly Conrad Ritzblatt.
What in hell's name are you up to? David demanded.
The old tenants have given notice and left. We're looking for new ones. Are you interested in looking over the property?
No, said David, backing away in panic. No, thank you.
He raced down the street, sweat beginning to show on his forehead, praying that the telephone box would still be empty. He flicked quickly through the L2R directory and looked up Bernie Silverman's secretary, Judith Lampson. This time there was a reply.
Judith, in God's name, what's going on?
His voice could have left her in no doubt how anxious he was.
No idea, replied Judith. I was given my notice on Friday night with a month's pay in advance and no explanation.
David dropped the telephone. The truth was slowly beginning to dawn on him, although he still wanted to believe there was some simple explanation. Whom could he turn to? What should he do? He returned in a daze to his flat in the Barbican. The Morning Post had arrived in his absence. It included a letter from the landlords of his flat. Corporation of London, Barbican Estate Office, London EC2, 01-628-4341. Dear Sir, we are sorry to learn you will be leaving at the end of the month, and would like to take this opportunity of thanking you for the payment of rent in advance. We should be pleased if you would kindly deposit the keys to this office at your earliest convenience. Yours faithfully, C.J. Castleton, Estate Manager. David stood frozen in the middle of the room, gazing at his new Underwood with sudden loathing. Finally, fearfully, he dialed his stockbrokers. What price are Prospector oiled this morning?
They've dipped to £3.80, replied the broker. Why have they fallen?
I've no idea, but I'll make some inquiries and ring you back. Please put my 500 shares on the market immediately. 500 Prospector oil at market price.
Yes, sir.
David put the phone down. It rang a few minutes later. It was his broker.
They've only made £3.50, exactly what you paid for them.
Would you credit the sum to my account at Lloyd's Bank, Moorgate Branch?
Of course, sir.
David did not leave the flat for the rest of the day or night. He lay on his bed, chain-smoking, wondering what he ought to do next, sometimes looking out of his little window over a rain-drenched city of banks, insurance companies, stockbrokers, and public companies. His own world. But for how much longer? In the morning, as soon as the market opened, he rang his broker again, in the hope that they would have some new information. Can you give me any more news on Prospector Oil? His voice was tense and weary now.
The news is bad, sir.
There's been a spate of heavy selling, and the shares have dropped to £2.80 on the opening of business this morning.
Why?
What the hell's going on? His voice rose with every word.
I've no idea, sir,
replied a calm voice that always made 1%, win or lose. David replaced the receiver. All those years at Harvard were about to be blown away in a puff of smoke. An hour passed,
but he did not notice it. He ate lunch in an inconspicuous restaurant and read a disturbing report in the London Evening Standard by its city editor, David Malbert, headlined "The Mystery of Prospector Oil." By the close of the stock exchange at 4 p.m, the shares had fallen to £1.60. David spent another restless night. He thought with pain and humiliation of how easily 2 months of good salary, a quick bonus, and a good deal of smooth talk had bought his unquestioning belief in an enterprise that should have excited all business suspicion. He felt sick as he recalled his man-to-man tips on Prospector Oil, whispered confidentially into willing ears. On Wednesday morning, dreading what he knew he was bound to hear, David once again rang the broker. The shares had collapsed to £1, and there was no longer a market for them. He left the flat and walked over to Lloyd's Bank, where he closed his account and drew out the remaining £1,345. The cashier smiled at him as she passed over the notes, thinking what a successful young man he must be. David picked up the final edition of the Evening Standard, the one marked 7RR in the right-hand corner. Prospector Oil had dropped again, this time to 25 pence. Numbed, he returned to his flat. The housekeeper was on the stairs.
"The police have been around inquiring after you, young man," she said haughtily.
David climbed the stairs, trying to look unperturbed.
"Thank you, Mrs. Pearson. I guess it's another parking fine I forgot to pay."
Panic had now taken over completely. David never felt so small, so lonely, and so sick in his life. He packed everything he owned into a suitcase, except the painting, which he left hanging on the wall, and booked a one-way ticket to New York. Chapter 4. Stephen Bradley was delivering a lecture on group theory at the Mathematics Institute in Oxford to a class of third-year undergraduates the morning David left. Over breakfast, he had read with horror in the Daily Telegraph of the collapse of Prospector Oil. He had immediately rung his broker, who was still trying to find out the full facts for him. He then phoned David Kessler, who seemed to have vanished without trace. The lecture Stephen was delivering was not going well. He was preoccupied, to say the least. He could only hope that the undergraduates would misconstrue his absent-mindedness as brilliance, rather than recognize it for what it was, total despair. He was at least thankful that it was his final lecture of the Hillary term. Stephen looked at the clock at the back of the lecture theatre every few minutes, until at last it pointed to the hour, and he was able to return to his rooms in Magdalen College. He sat in his old leather chair, wondering where to start. Why the hell had he put everything into one basket? How could he, normally so logical, so calculating, have been so recklessly stupid and greedy? He had trusted David, and still found it hard to believe that his friend was in any way involved with the collapse. Perhaps he shouldn't have taken for granted that someone he had befriended at Harvard must automatically be right. There had to be a simple explanation. Surely he must be able to get all his money back. The telephone rang. Perhaps it was his broker with more concrete news. As he picked up the phone, he realized for the first time that the palms of his hands were slippery with sweat.
"Stephen Bradley. Good morning, sir. I am sorry to bother you. My name is Detective Inspector Clifford Smith of the Fraud Squad, Scotland Yard. I was wondering if you would be kind enough to see me this afternoon."
Stephen hesitated, thinking wildly for a minute that he might have done something criminal by investing in Prospector Oil.
"Certainly, Inspector," he replied uncertainly. "Would you like me to travel to London?"
"No, sir," replied the inspector. "We'll come to you. We can be in Oxford by 4 p.m. if that's convenient."
"I'll expect you then. Goodbye, Inspector."
Stephen replaced the receiver. What could they want? He knew little of English law and hoped he was not going to be involved with the police as well. All this just 6 months before he was due to return to Harvard as a professor. Stephen was even beginning to wonder if that would materialize. The detective inspector was about 5 feet 11 inches in height, and somewhere between 45 and 50. His hair was turning grey at the sides, but Brilliantine toned it in with the original black. His shabby suit, Stephen suspected, was more indicative of a policeman's pay than of the inspector's personal taste. His heavy frame would have fooled most people into thinking he was rather slow. In fact,
Stephen was in the presence of one of the few men in England who fully understood the criminal mind. Time and time again, he had been the man behind the arrest of international defrauders. He had a tired look that came from years of putting men behind bars for major crimes, only to see them freed again shortly after and living comfortably off the spoils of their shady transactions. In his opinion, crime did pay. The department was so understaffed that some of the smaller fry even got away scot-free. Often the office of the Director of Public Prosecutions would decide it would be too expensive to follow the case through to a proper conclusion. On other occasions, the fraud squad simply did not have the backup staff to finish the job properly. The detective inspector was accompanied by Detective Sergeant Ryder, a considerably younger man, 6'1", thin in body and face. His large brown eyes had a more innocent look against his sallow skin. He was at least a little better dressed than the inspector, but then, thought Stephen, he probably wasn't married.
"I'm sorry about this intrusion, sir," began the inspector, after he had settled himself comfortably in the large armchair usually occupied by Stephen. "But I'm making inquiries into a company called Prospector Oil. Now, before you say anything, sir, we realise that you had no personal involvement in the running of this company, or indeed its subsequent collapse. But we do need your help, and I would prefer to ask you a series of questions which will bring out the points I need answered, rather than have you just give me a general assessment. I must tell you, sir, you don't have to answer any of my questions if you don't want to." Stephen nodded. "First, sir, what made you invest such a large amount in Prospector Oil?" The inspector had in front of him a sheet of paper with a list of all the investments made in the company over the past 4 months. "The advice of a friend," replied Stephen. "Mr. David Kessler, no doubt?"
"Yes."
"How do you know Mr. Kessler?"
"We were students at Harvard together, and when he took up his appointment in England to work for an oil company, I invited him down to Oxford for old time's sake."
Stephen went on to detail the full background of his association with David, and the reason he had been willing to invest such a large amount. He ended his explanation by asking if the inspector thought that David was criminally involved in the rise and fall of Prospector Oil.
"No, sir. My own view is that Kessler, who incidentally has made a run for it and left the country, is no more than the dupe of bigger men. But we would still like to question him. So if he contacts you, please let me know immediately."
"Now, sir," the inspector continued, "I'm going to read you a list of names, and I would be obliged if you could tell me whether you have ever met, spoken to, or heard of any of them. Harvey Metcalf?"
"No," said Stephen.
"Bernie Silverman?"
"I've never met or spoken to him, but David did mention his name in conversation when he dined with me here in college."
The detective sergeant was writing down everything Stephen said, slowly and methodically.
"Richard Elliot?"
"The same applies to him as Silverman."
"Alvin Cooper?"
"No," said Stephen. "Have you had any contact with anyone else who was involved in the company?"
"No."
For well over an hour, the inspector quizzed Stephen on minor points, but he was unable to give him very much help, although he had kept the copy of the geologist's report.
"Yes, sir. We are in possession of one of those documents, sir," said the inspector,
"but it's cleverly worded. I doubt if we'll be able to rely much on that for evidence." Stephen sighed and offered the two men some whiskey and poured himself a Dawnish dry sherry.
"Evidence against whom or for what, Inspector?" he said as he returned to his chair. "It's clear to me that I've been taken for a sucker. I probably don't need to tell you what a fool I've made of myself. I put my shirt on Prospector Oil because it sounded like a surefire winner, and ended up losing everything I had without having a clue what to do about it. What, in heaven's name, has been going on in Prospector Oil?"
"Well, sir," said the inspector, "you'll appreciate there are aspects of the case I'm not at liberty to discuss with you. Indeed, there are some things that aren't very clear to us yet. But the game isn't a new one, and this time it's been played by an old pro, a very cunning old pro. It works something like this. A company is set up, or taken over, by a bunch of villains who acquire the majority of the shares. They invent a plausible story about a new discovery or super product that will send the shares up, whisper it in a few willing ears,
release their own shares onto the market and let them be snapped up by the likes of you, sir, at a higher price. Then they clear off with the profit they have made, after which the shares collapse because the company has no real substance. As often as not, it ends with dealings in the shares being suspended on the stock market, and finally in the compulsory liquidation of the company. This hasn't happened yet in this case, and it may not. The London Stock Exchange is only just recovering from the Kaplan fiasco, and they don't want another scandal on their hands. I'm sorry to say that we can hardly ever recover the money, even if we produce enough evidence to nail the villains. They have it all stashed away all over the world before you can say Dow Jones Index. Stephen groaned. My God, you make it all sound so appallingly simple, Inspector. The geologist's report was a fake, then? Not exactly, sir. Very impressively worded and well presented, but with plenty of ifs and buts. And one thing is for certain, the DPP's office is hardly likely to spend millions finding out if there is any oil in that part of the North Sea. Stephen buried his head in his hands and mentally cursed the day he met David Kessler. Tell me, Inspector, who put Kessler up to this? Who was the real brains behind it all? The inspector realized only too well the terrible agony Stephen was going through. During his career, he had faced many men in the same position, and he was grateful for Stephen's cooperation. I'll answer any question I feel cannot harm my own inquiry, said the inspector. But it's no secret that the man we'd like to nail is Harvey Metcalf. Who's Harvey Metcalf, for God's sake? He's a first-generation American who's had his fingers in more dubious deals in Boston than you've had hot dinners, made himself a multimillionaire and a lot of other people bankrupt on the way. His style is so professional and predictable, now we can smell the man a mile off. It will not amuse you to learn that he is a great benefactor of Harvard. Does it to ease his conscience, no doubt. We've never been able to pin anything on him in the past, and I doubt if we'll be able to this time either. He was never a director of Prospector Oil, and he only bought and sold shares on the open market. He never, as far as we know, even met David Kessler. He hired Silverman, Cooper, and Elliot to do the dirty work, and they found a bright, enthusiastic young man, all freshly washed behind the ears, to sell their story for them. I'm afraid it was a bit unlucky for you, sir, that the young man in question was your friend, David Kessler. Never mind him, poor sod, said Stephen. What about Harvey Metcalf? Is he going to get away with it again? I fear so, said the inspector. We have warrants out for the arrest of Silverman, Elliot, and Cooper. They all beat it off to South America. After the Ronald Biggs fiasco, I doubt if we'll ever get an extradition order to bring them back, even though the American and Canadian police also have warrants out for them. They were fairly cunning, too. They closed the London office of Prospector Oil, surrendered the lease and returned it to Conrad Ritblatt, the estate agents, and gave notice to both secretaries with 1 month's pay in advance. They cleared the bill on the oil rig with Redding and Bates. They paid off their hired hand, Mark Stewart in Aberdeen, and took the Sunday morning flight to Rio de Janeiro, where there was $1 million in a private account waiting for them. Another 2 or 3 years after they've spent all the money, and they'll undoubtedly turn up again with different names and a different company. Harvey Metcalf rewarded them well and left David Kessler holding the baby. Clever boys, said Stephen. Oh, yes, said the inspector. It was a neat little operation, worthy of the talents of Harvey Metcalf. Are you trying to arrest David Kessler? No, but as I said, we would like to question him. He bought and sold 500 shares, but we think that was only because he believed in the oil strike story himself. In fact, if he was wise, he would return to England and help the police with their inquiries, but I fear the poor man has panicked under pressure and made a bolt for it. The American police are keeping an eye out for him. One last question, said Stephen. Are there any other people who made such fools of themselves as I did? The inspector gave this question long consideration. He had not had as much success with the other big investors as he had had with Stephen. They had all been evasive about their involvement with Kessler and Prospector Oil. Perhaps if he released their names, it might bring them out in some way. Yes, sir, but you must understand that you never heard about them from me. Stephen nodded.
For your own interest, you could find out what you need to know by making some discreet inquiries through the stock exchange. There were four main punters, of whom you were one. Between the four of you, you lost approximately $1 million. The others were a Harley Street doctor, Robin Oakley, a London art dealer called Jean-Pierre Lemann, and a farmer, the unluckiest of all, really. As far as I can gather, he mortgaged his farm to put up the money. Titled young gentleman, Viscount Briggsley. Metcalf snatched the silver spoon out of his mouth, all right. No other big investors? Two or three banks burned their fingers badly, but there were no other private investors above £10,000. What you, the banks, and the other big investors did was to keep the market buoyant long enough for Metcalf to offload his entire holding. I know, and worse, I foolishly advised some of my friends to invest in the company as well. There are two or three small investors from Oxford. Yes, sir, said the inspector, looking down at the sheet of paper in front of him. But don't worry, we won't be approaching them. Well, that seems to be all. It only leaves me to thank you for your cooperation and say we may be in touch again sometime in the future. In any case, we'll keep you informed of developments, and I hope you'll do the same for us. Of course, Inspector. I do hope you have a safe journey back to town. The two policemen downed their drinks and left. Stephen could never recall if it was while sitting in his armchair looking out at the cloisters, or later in bed that night, that he decided to employ his academic mind to carry out a little research on Harvey Metcalf and his fellow dupers. His grandfather's advice to him, when as a small child he failed to win their nightly game of chess, floated across his mind. Stevie, don't get cross. Get even. He was pleased he had given his final lecture and finished work for the term, and as he fell asleep at 3 a.m., only one name was on his lips. Harvey Metcalf. Chapter 5. Stephen awoke at about 5:30 a.m. He seemed to have been heavily, dreamlessly asleep, but as soon as he came to, the nightmare started again. He forced himself to use his mind constructively, to put the past firmly behind him and see what could be done about the future. He washed, shaved, dressed, and missed college breakfast, occasionally murmuring to himself, Harvey Metcalf. He then pedalled to Oxford Station on an ancient bicycle, his preferred mode of transport in a city blocked solid with juggernaut lorries and full of unintelligible one-way systems. He left Ethelred the Unsteady padlocked to the station railings. There were as many bicycles standing in the ranks as there are cars in other railway stations. He caught the 8:17 train, so favoured by those who commute from Oxford to London every day. All the people at breakfast seemed to know each other, and Stephen felt like an uninvited guest at someone else's party. The ticket collector bustled through the buffet car and clipped Stephen's first-class ticket. The man opposite Stephen produced a second-class ticket from behind his copy of the Financial Times. The collector clipped it, grudgingly. You'll have to return to a second-class compartment when you've finished your breakfast, sir. The restaurant car is first-class, you know. Stephen considered the implication of these remarks as he watched the flat Berkshire countryside jolt past, and his coffee cup lurched unsampled in its saucer before he turned his mind to the morning papers. The Times carried no news of Prospector Oil that morning. It was, he supposed, an insignificant story, even a dull one. Not kidnap, not arson, not even rape. Just another shady business enterprise collapsing. Nothing there to hold the attention of the front page for more than one day. Not a story he would have given a second thought to himself, but for his own involvement, which gave it all the makings of a personal tragedy. At Paddington, he pushed through the ants rushing around the forecourt, glad that he had chosen the closeted life of a university, or, more accurately, that it had chosen him. Stephen had never come to terms with London. He found the city large and impersonal, and he always took a taxi everywhere for fear of getting lost on the buses or the underground. Why didn't the English number their streets so Americans would know where they were? The Times office, Printing House Square. The cabbie nodded and moved his black Austin deftly down the Bayswater Road, alongside a rain-sodden Hyde Park. The crocuses at Marble Arch looked sullen and battered, splayed wetly on the close grass. Stephen was impressed by London cabs. They never had a scrape or mark on them.
He had once been told that cab drivers are not allowed to pick up fares unless their vehicles are in perfect condition. How different from New York's battered yellow monsters, he thought. The cabbie proceeded to swing down Park Lane to Hyde Park Corner, past the House of Commons and along the embankment. The flags were out in Parliament Square. Stephen frowned. What was the lead story he had read over so inattentively in the train? Ah, yes, a meeting of Commonwealth leaders. He supposed he must allow the world to go about its daily business as usual. Stephen was unsure how to tackle the problem of checking Harvey Metcalf out. Back at Harvard, he would have had no trouble, first making a beeline for his father's old friend, Hank Swaltz, the business correspondent of the Herald American. Hank would be sure to have supplied him with the inside dope. The diary correspondent of the Times, Richard Compton Miller, was by no means as appropriate a contact, but he was the only British pressman Stephen had ever met. Compton Miller had been visiting Magdalen the previous spring to write a feature on the time-honoured observance of May Day in Oxford. The choristers on the top of the college tower had sung the Miltonian salute as the sun peeped over the horizon on May 1st. Hail, bounteous May that doth inspire mirth and youth and warm desire. On the banks of the river beneath Magdalen Bridge, where Compton Miller and Stephen had stood, several couples had clearly been inspired. Later, Stephen had been more embarrassed than flattered by his appearance in the resulting piece written by Compton Miller for the Times Diary. Academics are sparing with the word brilliant, but journalists are not. The more self-important of Stephen's senior common room colleagues had not been amused to see him described as the brightest star in a firmament of moderate luminescence. The taxi pulled into the forecourt and came to a stop by the side of a massive hunk of sculpture by Henry Moore. The Times and the Observer shared a building with separate entrances. The Times is by far the more prestigious. Stephen asked the sergeant behind the desk for Richard Compton Miller, and was directed to the fifth floor, and then to his little private cubicle at the end of the corridor. It was only a little after 10 a.m. when Stephen arrived, and the building was practically deserted. Compton Miller later explained that a national newspaper does not begin to wake up until 11 a.m., and generally indulges itself in a long lunch hour until about 3. Between then and putting the paper to bed, about 8:30 p.m., for all but the front page, the real work is done. There is usually a complete change of staff, staggered from 5 p.m. onward, whose job it is to watch for major news stories breaking during the night. They always have to keep a wary eye on what is happening in America, because if the president makes an important statement in the afternoon in Washington, they are already going to press in London. Sometimes the front page can change as often as 5 times during the night. In the case of the assassination of President Kennedy, news of which first reached England about 7 p.m. on the evening of November 22, 1963, the entire front page had to be scrapped to make way for the tragedy.
"Richard, it was kind of you to come in early for me. I didn't realize that you started work so late. I rather take my daily paper for granted."
Richard laughed.
"That's okay. We must seem a lazy bunch to you, but this place will be buzzing at midnight when you're tucked up in bed and sound asleep. Now, how can I help you?"
"I'm trying to do a little research on a fellow countryman of mine called Harvey Metcalf. He's a substantial benefactor of Harvard, and I want to flatter the old boy by knowing all about him when I return." Stephen didn't care very much for the lie, but these were strange circumstances he now found himself in.
"Hang on here, and I'll go and see if we have anything in the cutting room on him."
Stephen amused himself by reading the headlines pinned on Compton Miller's board, obviously stories he had taken some pride in. "Prime Minister to conduct orchestra at Royal Festival Hall. Miss World loves Tom Jones. Muhammad Ali says, I will be champion again." Richard returned 15 minutes later, carrying a thickish file.
"Have a go at that, Descartes. I'll be back in an hour, and we can have some coffee."
Stephen nodded and smiled gratefully. Descartes never had to solve the problems he was facing. Everything Harvey Metcalf wanted the world to know was in that file, and a little bit he didn't want the world to know. Stephen learned of his yearly trips to Europe to visit Wimbledon, of the success of his horses at Ascot, and of his pursuit of impressionist pictures for his private art collection. William Hickey of the Daily Express had on one occasion titillated his readers with a plump Harvey clad in Bermuda shorts and a report that he spent 2 or 3 weeks a year on his private yacht at Monte Carlo,
gambling at the casino. Hickey's tone was something less than fulsome. The Metcalf fortune was, in his opinion, too new to be respectable. Stephen wrote down meticulously all the facts he thought relevant and was studying the photographs when Richard returned. He took Stephen off to have some coffee in the canteen on the same floor. Cigarette smoke swirled mistily around the girl at the cashier's desk at the end of the self-service counter.
"Richard, I don't quite have all the information I might need. Harvard wants to touch this man for quite a large sum. I believe they are thinking in terms of about $1 million. Where could I find out some more about him?"
"New York Times, I should imagine," said Compton Miller. "Come on, we'll give Terry Robards a visit."
The New York Times office in London was also on the fifth floor of the Times building in Printing House Square.
Stephen thought of the vast New York Times building on 43rd Street and wondered if the London Times had a reciprocal arrangement and was secreted away in their basement. Terry Robards turned out to be a wiry American wearing a perpetual smile. Terry immediately made Stephen feel at ease, a knack he had developed almost subconsciously over the years, and which was a great asset when digging a little deeper for stories. Stephen repeated his piece about Metcalf. Terry laughed.
"Harvard isn't too fussy where they get their money from, are they? That guy has discovered more legal ways of stealing money than the Internal Revenue Service."
"You don't say," said Stephen innocently. The New York Times file on Harvey was voluminous. Metcalf's rise from messenger boy to millionaire, as one headline put it, was documented admirably. Stephen took further careful notes. The details of Sharpley and Son fascinated him, as did the facts on some wartime arms dealing and the background of his wife Arlene and their daughter, Rosalie. There was a picture of both of them, but the daughter was only 15 at the time. There were also long reports of two court cases some 25 years past, in which Harvey had been charged with fraud but never convicted, and a more recent case in 1956 concerning a share transfer scheme in Boston. Again, Harvey had escaped the law, but the district attorney had left the jury in little doubt of his views on Mr. Metcalf. The most recent press stories were all in the gossip columns. Metcalf's paintings, his horses, his orchids, his daughter's success at Vassar, and his trips to Europe. Of Prospector Oil there was not a word. Stephen had to admire Harvey's ability to conceal his more dubious activities from the press. Terry invited his fellow expatriate to lunch. Newsmen always like new contacts, and Stephen looked like a promising one. He asked the cabbie to go to Whitfield Street. As they inched their way out of the city into the West End, Stephen hoped that the meal would be worth the journey. He was not disappointed. Lacey's restaurant was airy and bedecked with clean linen and young daffodils. Terry said it was greatly favoured by pressmen. Margaret Costa, the cookery writer, and her chef husband, Bill Lacey, certainly knew their onions. Of a delicious watercress soup, followed by medaillon de veau de la crème au calvados and a bottle of Chateau de Perron 1972, Terry became quite expansive on the subject of Harvey Metcalf. He had interviewed him once at Harvard, on the occasion of the opening of Metcalf Hall, which included a gymnasium and four indoor tennis courts.
"Hoping to get himself an honorary degree one day," said Terry cynically, "but not much hope, even if he gives a billion."
Stephen noted the words thoughtfully.
"I guess you could get some more facts on the guy at the American Embassy," said Terry.
He glanced at his watch.
"No, hell, the library closes at 4 p.m. Too late today. Time I got back to the office, now America's awake."
Stephen wondered if pressmen ate and drank like that every day. They made university dons look positively celibate, and however did they manage to get a paper out? Stephen fought his way onto the 5:15 train to return with the Oxford-bound commuters, and only when he was alone in his room did he begin to study the results of his day's work. Though exhausted, he forced himself to sit at his desk until he had prepared the first neat draft of a dossier on Harvey Metcalf. Next day, Stephen again caught the 8:17 to London, this time buying a second-class ticket. The ticket collector repeated his piece about leaving the restaurant car after he had finished his meal.
"Sure,"
said Stephen, as he toyed with the remains of his coffee for the rest of the hour-long journey, never shifting from first class. He was pleased with himself. He had saved £2, and that was exactly how Harvey Metcalf would have behaved.
At Paddington, he followed Terry Robards' advice and took a taxi to the American Embassy, a vast, monolithic building which sprawls over 250,000 square feet and is 9 stories high, stretching the entire length of one side of Grosvenor Square. It was not, however, as elegant as the American ambassador's magnificent official residence, Winfield House in Regent's Park, where Stephen had been summoned to drinks last year, which was once the private home of Barbara Hutton, before it was sold to the American government in 1946. Certainly either of them was large enough for 7 husbands, thought Stephen. The entrance to the embassy reference library on the ground floor was firmly shut. Stephen was reduced to a close study of the plaques on the wall in the corridor outside, honouring recent ambassadors to the court of St. James. Reading backward from Walter Annenberg, he had reached Joseph Kennedy when the doors of the library swung open, not unlike a bank. The prim girl behind a sign marked Inquiries was not immediately forthcoming on the subject of Harvey Metcalfe. "Why do you require this information?" she asked sharply. This threw Stephen for a moment, but he quickly recovered. "I'm returning to Harvard in the fall as a professor, and I feel I should know more about his involvement with the university. I'm at present a visiting fellow at Magdalen College, Oxford." Stephen's answer motivated the girl to immediate action, and she produced a file within a few minutes. Though by no means as racy as the New York Times's, it did put figures on the amounts Harvey Metcalfe had donated to charity, and gave precise details of his gifts to the Democratic Party. Most people do not divulge the exact amount they give to political parties, but Harvey only knew about lights. No one seemed to have told him about bushels. Having finished his research at the embassy, Stephen took a taxi to the Cunard offices in St. James's Square and spoke to a booking clerk, and from there on to Claridge's in Brook Street, where he spent a few minutes with the duty manager. A telephone call to Monte Carlo completed his research. He travelled back to Oxford on the 5:15. Stephen returned to his college rooms. He felt he now knew as much about Harvey Metcalfe as anyone, except perhaps for Arlene and Detective Inspector Clifford Smith of the Fraud Squad. Once again he stayed up into the early hours completing his dossier, which now ran to over 40 typewritten pages. When the dossier was finally completed, he went to bed and fell into a deep sleep. He rose again early in the morning, strolled across the cloisters to a common room breakfast, and helped himself to eggs, bacon, coffee and toast. He then took his dossier to the bursar's office, where he made 4 copies of every document, ending up with 5 dossiers in all. He strolled back across Magdalen Bridge, admiring as always the trim flower beds of the University Botanic Gardens beneath him on his right, and called in at Maxwell's bookshop on the other side of the bridge. Stephen returned to his rooms with 5 smart files, all of different colours. He then placed the 5 dossiers in the separate files and put them in a drawer of his desk, which he kept locked. Stephen had a tidy and methodical mind, as a mathematician must, a mind the like of which Harvey Metcalfe had never yet come up against. Stephen then referred to the notes he had written after his interview with Detective Inspector Smith and rang directory inquiries, asking for the London addresses and telephone numbers of Dr. Robin Oakley, Jean-Pierre Lamann, and Lord Briggsley. Directory inquiries refused to give him more than 2 numbers at any one time. Stephen wondered how the GPO expected to make a profit. In the States, the Bell Telephone Company would happily have given him 12 telephone numbers and still ended with the inevitable, "You're welcome." The 2 he managed to wheedle out of his reluctant informant were Dr. Robin Oakley, at 122 Harley Street, London, W1, and Jean-Pierre Lamann, at the Lamann Gallery, 40 New Bond Street, W1. Stephen then dialed directory inquiries a 2nd time and requested the number and address of Lord Briggsley. "No one under Briggsley in central London," said the operator. "Maybe he's ex-directory. That is, if he really is a lord," she sniffed. Stephen left his study for the senior common room, where he thumbed through the latest copy of Who's Who, and found the noble lord. Briggsley, Viscount, James Clarence Spencer, born 11 October 1942, farmer, son and heir of 5th Earl of Louth, created 1764, quod vive, educated Harrow, Christchurch, Oxford, B.A., President Oxford University Dramatic Society, Lieutenant Grenadier Guards, 1966 to 1968, recreations, polo, not water, shooting,
Address, Tathwell Hall, Louth, Lincolnshire. Clubs, Garrick, Guards. Stephen then strolled over to Christchurch and asked the secretary in the treasurer's office if she had in her records a London address for James Briggsley, matriculated 1963. It was duly supplied as 119 King's Road, London, SW3. Stephen was beginning to warm to the challenge of Harvey Metcalf. He left Christchurch by Peckwater and the Canterbury Gate, out into the High and back to Magdalen, hands in pockets, composing a brief letter in his mind. Oxford's nocturnal slogan writers had been at work on a college wall again. "Deans means fines," said one neatly painted graffito. Stephen, the reluctant junior dean of Magdalen, responsible for undergraduate discipline, smiled. If they were funny enough, he would allow them to remain for one term. If not, he would have the porter scrub them out immediately. Back at his desk, he wrote down what had been in his mind. Magdalen College, Oxford, April 15th. "Dear Dr. Oakley, I am holding a small dinner party in my rooms next Thursday evening for a few carefully selected people. I would be delighted if you could spare the time to join me, and I think you would find it worth your while to be present. Yours sincerely, Stephen Bradley. P.S. I am sorry David Kessler is unable to join us. Black tie, 7:30 for 8 p.m. Stephen changed the sheet of letter paper in his old Remington typewriter and addressed similar letters to Jean-Pierre Lamann and Lord Briggsley. Then he sat thinking for a little while before picking up the internal telephone. "Harry," he said to the head porter, "if anyone rings the lodge to ask if the college has a fellow called Stephen Bradley, I want you to say, 'Yes, sir, a new mathematics fellow from Harvard, already famous for his dinner parties.' Is that clear, Harry?"
"Yes, sir," said Harry Woodley, the head porter. He had never understood Americans. Dr. Bradley was no exception.
All three men did ring and inquire, as Stephen had anticipated they might. He himself would have done the same in the circumstances. Harry remembered his message and repeated it carefully, although the callers still seemed a little baffled. "Now more than me, or is it I?" muttered the head porter. Stephen received acceptances from all three during the next week, James Briggsley's arriving last, on the Friday. The crest on his letter paper announced a promising motto, "Ex nihilo omnia." The butler to the senior common room and the college chef were consulted, and a meal to loosen the tongues of the most taciturn was planned. Coquille Saint-Jacques, Pouilly Fuissé, 1969, Carré d'agneau en croûte, Feu Saint-Jean, 1970, Casserole d'artichaut et champignons, Pommes de terre boulangère, Grise torta with raspberries, Barsac, Chateau d'Yquem, 1927, Camembert frappé, Port Taylor, 1947, Café. Everything was ready. All Stephen could do now was wait for the appointed hour. On the stroke of 7:30 p.m., on the appointed Thursday, Jean-Pierre arrived. Stephen admired the elegant dinner jacket and large, floppy bow tie that his guest wore, while he fingered his own little clip-on, surprised that Jean-Pierre Lamann, who had such obvious savoir-faire, could also have fallen victim to Prospector Oil. Stephen plunged into a monologue on the significance of the isosceles triangle in modern art, while Jean-Pierre stroked his moustache. It was not a subject Stephen would normally have chosen to speak on without a break for 5 minutes, and he was only saved from the inevitability of more direct questions from Jean-Pierre by the arrival of Dr. Robin Oakley. Robin had lost a few pounds in the past month, but Stephen could see why his practice in Harley Street was a success. He was, in the words of H.H. Munro, a man whose looks made it possible for women to forgive any other trifling inadequacies. Robin studied his shambling host, wondering whether he dared to ask immediately if they had ever met before. No, he decided, he would leave it a little and hope perhaps some clue as to why he had been invited would materialize during dinner. The David Kessler P.S. worried him. Stephen introduced him to Jean-Pierre, and they chatted while their host checked the dinner table. Once again the door opened, and with a little more respect than previously displayed, the porter announced, "Lord Briggsley." Stephen walked forward to greet him, suddenly unsure whether he should bow or shake hands. Although James did not know anyone present at the strange gathering, he showed no signs of discomfort and entered easily into the conversation.
Even Stephen was impressed by James's relaxed line of small talk, although he couldn't help recalling his academic results when at Christchurch and wondered whether the noble lord would in fact be an asset to his plans. The culinary efforts of the chef worked their intended magic. No guest could possibly have asked his host why the dinner party was taking place, while such delicately garlic-flavoured lamb, such tender almond pastry, such excellent wine were still to hand. Finally, when the servants had cleared the table and the port was on its way around for the second time, Robin could stand it no longer. "If it's not a rude question, Dr. Bradley, do call me Stephen. Stephen, may I ask what is the purpose of this select little gathering?" Six eyes bored into him, demanding an answer to the same question. Stephen rose and surveyed his guests. He walked around the table twice before speaking, and then started his discourse by recalling the entire history of the past few weeks. He told them of his meeting in that very room with David Kessler, his investment in Prospector Oil, followed soon afterward by the visit of the fraud squad and their disclosure about Harvey Metcalf. He ended his carefully prepared speech with the words, "Gentlemen, the truth is that the four of us are in the same bloody mess." He felt that sounded suitably British. Jean-Pierre reacted even before Stephen could finish what he was saying. "Count me out. I couldn't be involved in anything quite so ridiculous as that. I am a humble art dealer, not a speculator." Robin Oakley also jumped in before Stephen was given the chance to reply. "I've never heard anything so preposterous. You must have contacted the wrong man. I'm a Harley Street doctor. I don't know the first thing about oil." Stephen could see why the fraud squad had had trouble with these two, and why they had been so thankful for his cooperation. They all looked at Lord Briggsley, who raised his eyes and said very quietly, "Absolutely right on every detail, Dr. Bradley, and I'm in more of a pickle than you. I borrowed £150,000 to buy the shares against the security of my small farm in Hampshire, and I don't think it will be long before my bank insists that I dispose of it. When they do, and my dear old Pa, the 5th Earl, finds out, it's curtains for me unless I become the 6th Earl overnight." "Thank you," said Stephen. As he sat down, he turned to Robin and raised his eyebrows interrogatively. "What the hell?" said Robin. "You're quite right. I was involved. David Kessler was a patient of mine, and in a rash moment, I invested £100,000 in Prospector Oil as a temporary advance against my securities. God only knows what made me do it. As the shares are only worth 50 pence, I'm stuck with them. I have a shortfall at my bank, which they're beginning to fuss about. I also have a large mortgage on my country home in Berkshire, and a heavy rent on my Harley Street consulting room, a wife with expensive tastes, and two boys at the best private prep school in England. I've hardly slept a wink since Detective Inspector Smith visited me 2 weeks ago." He looked up. His face had drained of colour, and the suave self-confidence of Harley Street had gone. Slowly they all turned and stared at Jean-Pierre. "All right, all right," he admitted. "Me too. I was in Paris when the damn thing folded under me, so now I'm stuck with the useless shares. £80,000, borrowed against my stock at the gallery. And what's worse, I advised some of my friends to invest in the bloody company too." Silence enveloped the room. It was Jean-Pierre who broke it again. "So, what do you suggest, Professor?" he said sarcastically. "Do we hold an annual dinner to remind us what fools we've been?" "No, that was not what I had in mind." Stephen hesitated, realizing that what he was about to suggest was bound to cause even more commotion. Once again he rose to his feet and said quietly and deliberately, "We have had our money stolen by a very clever man who has proved to be an expert in share fraud. None of us is knowledgeable about stocks and shares, but we are all experts in our own fields. Gentlemen, I therefore suggest we steal it back. Not a penny more, and not a penny less." A few seconds' silence was followed by uproar. "Just walk up and take it, I suppose," said Robin. "Kidnap him," mused James. "Why don't we just kill him and claim the life insurance?" said Jean-Pierre. Several moments passed. Stephen waited until he had complete silence again, and then he handed around the four dossiers marked Harvey Metcalf, with each of their names below. A green dossier for Robin, a blue one for James, and a yellow
for Jean-Pierre. The Red Master copy Stephen kept for himself. They were all impressed. While they had been wringing their hands in unproductive dismay, it was obvious that Stephen Bradley had been hard at work. Stephen continued, "Please read your dossier carefully. It will brief you on everything that is known about Harvey Metcalf. Each of you must take the document away and study the information, and then return with a plan of how we are between us, to extract $1 million from him without his ever being aware of it. All four of us must come up with a separate plan. Each may involve the other three in his own operation. We will return here in 14 days' time and present our conclusions. Each member of the team will put $10,000 into the kitty as a float, and I, as the mathematician, will keep a running account. All expenses incurred in retrieving our money will be added to Mr. Metcalf's bill, starting with your journey down here this evening and the cost of the dinner tonight." Jean-Pierre and Robin began to protest again, but it was James who stopped the proceedings by simply saying, "I agree. What have we got to lose? On our own, we've no chance at all. Together, we might just tweak the bastard." Robin and Jean-Pierre looked at each other, shrugged and nodded. The four of them settled down to discuss in detail the material Stephen had acquired over the past few days. They left the college a little after midnight, each agreeing to have a plan ready for the team's consideration in 14 days' time. None of them was quite sure where it all might end, but each was relieved to know he was no longer on his own. Stephen decided that the first part of the team versus Harvey Metcalf had gone as well as he could have wished. He only hoped his conspirators would now get down to work. He sat in his armchair, stared at the ceiling, and continued thinking.